It's time for Listen Up, a series of conversations with children's book authors and illustrators, educators and literacy experts. At first glance, humorist Dave Barry and crime novelist Ridley Pearson don't appear to be natural collaborators, especially not for a middle grade fiction series that functions as a prequel to Peter Pan. Yet that's exactly what this decidedly dynamic duo teamed up to do, much to the delight of their young readers, and readers who are young at heart. Listen up as Dave and Ridley talk about Bridge to Neverland, the fifth installment in their best-selling Starcatcher series, which hit shelves last week.
I'm Dave Barry.
I'm Ridley Pearson.
And we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff.
Or not.
Or not. But we're. I think we're going to start with the beginning here.
We might as well. The actual beginning.
The beginning. Well, yeah. It all begins when the beginning of our relationship.
Right.
I think it goes back.
Don't get too deep about our relationship.
And I don't mean in a bad way our relationship. But we met through music, or sort of music.
What passes for music?
It really doesn't pass that well for music. But that we were in a band. Ridley and I are in a band called the Rock Bottom Remainders, which is a band of authors, including Stephen King, Amy Tan, Mitch Albom, Scott Turow, Roy Blunt Jr., Greg Iles, and random other people sometimes.
Dave's brother.
My brother Sam. Kathy Goldmark.
Every time you can get a band with Sam and Dave.
Sam and Dave in the band. Yeah. And so we were playing. We suck as a band, to be truthful.
We're pathetic.
But we became good friends, Ridley and I. And that's really how we ended, weirdly enough, even though when we met, Ridley was writing thrillers.
I was killing people,
and I was writing booger jokes. We ended up writing books for children or young adults.
Because as parents, we were reading to our kids.
And what happened then?
Well, Dave, let me explain. One night, I was reading Peter Pan to my then 5-year-old daughter, and she put her hand across the book and said, "Hey, Dad, how did Peter meet Captain Hook in the first place?" And as a writer, you're always looking for ideas, and I kind of went, "Hey, how come he never grows old? How can he fly? Why does he want to detach from his shadow?" And because you're such a generous guy, Dave, a week later, I was staying at your house for one of our performances, and we were eating breakfast, and you politely said, "What are you up to?" And I said, "Well, you know, Paige asked me this question, and I'm thinking about writing a prequel to Peter Pan," and your eyes kind of went wide. They were bloodshot, but we won't get into that. And we have this rule in this band that we don't talk business. And so I was very shy, and I felt like sort of a seventh grade boy asking a girl out on a date. And I clutched my hands beneath the table and said to you, "Dave, would you ever consider writing this with me? Because I kill people for a living." And you said, "I'm in." Then what happened, Dave?
Well, we had this idea in mind that it was going to be this little book, at least I did.
Yeah, like 90 pages.
And it would be really easy to write. And that we'd be done with it. And we didn't have a publisher. We had nothing. We just thought, well, we'll knock this little thing out, and that'll be that. And we ended up writing a book called Peter and the Starcatchers, which is 500 and something pages long. And it really just sort of got into the very beginning of the
barely cracks
Peter Pan story.
There.
But we had to develop a way to do it and to write a book together, because neither one of us had ever done that. And Ridley had this idea, this is going to sound so crazy, it still does to me, that we should know the plot of the book before we started writing. Apparently that's a tradition in writers. I was totally unaware of this.
It's that word outline.
Never had thought of that.
I had to get out Webster's.
I always just sort of plunge in. But Ridley, he wanted us to figure out the story. So we did. We figured out the whole story, which required a lot of talking, yelling, and arguing. We had some arguments. And you have to imagine, two grown men are trying to come up with a plausible explanation for how a boy ends up on an island with all kinds of magical creatures and never grows old and can fly. And we had arguments where I would yell at Ridley, and I wasn't kidding, it wasn't meant to be funny. A mermaid would not do that. You know, like I knew what a mermaid would do. So, but we did. We came up with a plot, and we came up with this idea of star stuff, and we wrote this huge book.
Huge book.
And we did it by a process we call ping pong. Want to explain ping pong?
Yeah, we had read a couple collaborative efforts where it was really obvious that author A had taken the first chapter and author B had taken the second, on and on through the book, and it just didn't seem like there was a continuity to it. And we talked about, is there some way we could write with a voice? And we ended up dividing the book by character. So one of us took the funny, childlike, happy characters, I won't mention any names, and one of us took the psychopathic, piratical characters. And if chapter three was mostly the pirates or the piratical weirdos, I would write the first draft and send it to Dave. And this is where we parted from typical New York publishing, is we just operated on this premise of trust, and the other guy could change the chapter however he wished with no explanation. Usually you get these 20-page letters of, you know, I felt your prose was wandering into the... We didn't do any of that. We just would rip a chapter out, rip a paragraph out, rip a sentence out, whatever, and plug in our own thoughts. And so the early on, I distinctly remember sending my chapter to Dave, and I sent 20 pages or something, and it came back 20 pages, but only 10 were my pages. And there was a terrific paragraph that had been left on the cutting room floor. So I very surreptitiously stuffed it back into the prose, sent it back to Dave, and sure enough, when it came back, it was gone again. And then I realized, okay, this is not going to work if that paragraph is obviously dead. And we ended up, I don't know, we would go, initially, I think we were going back 6-8 times on these things, trying to find what the other guy wanted, really, out of our work. And we got maybe halfway through that first book, and we had found this third voice. It wasn't exactly me, it wasn't exactly Dave. And we started, you know, because of this process, we were stepping on each other. So I would write what I thought was just superior, piratical dialogue, and it would come back way better and a lot funnier because Dave had walked all over my dialogue. So it was really, I mean, it was a terrific, and it's been fun ever since. We've done, what, a dozen books now, so.
We discovered this sort of amazing thing, I'm not sure why we thought it was a good idea to write children's books, but we were probably more thinking of our own kids than anyone else.
Exactly.
But we discovered all these other wonderful things about writing for kids, which is when you write for adults and you go do a book signing, typically, you know, they're polite, they listen with interest, they want to know things like, do you need an agent to write? Is this going to become a movie? What were the reviews like? That kind of thing. But they ask a lot about the process of writing and things sort of ancillary to the book itself. And what we found, our first signing, I'll never forget, was in Miami at a wonderful store called Books and Books. And we show up there and there's like 300 kids dressed as pirates. And they got swords and, you know, eye patches and are running around yelling. And half of them had already read the book. And they were so uninterested in us or how we wrote it. What they wanted to know is, why does the alligator, you know, whatever. They had all these questions that were very specific
to the story.
And I forget, I was outside my daughter's school. My daughter was then in third grade. And one of the older girls, a fifth grade girl, was walking to school. And she's reading a book, one of our books, as she's walking.
And being led by
her mom is kind of guiding her because she's so busy reading, she's not looking where she's going. And I thought, well, that's so cool. You know, there she is, she's reading. I'm one of the authors of that book. I'm going to go give that little girl a thrill. So I go over and I tap her on the shoulder and she looks up and I go, I'm one of the guys who wrote that book. And she goes, oh, and goes back to reading the book. Not even remotely interested in talking to me or anything else. When you're a writer, that's the best possible kind of reader. They don't really care about anything but the story. And that's what kept us going, I think. That and the fact that we really sort of felt that we had only begun when we wrote Peter and the Star Catchers. So we wrote the second book we wrote was called Peter and the Shadow Thieves. And to do that, we decided we needed to go to London because we set the book in London and also would be tax deductible.
That's the main reason
to go
right there.
So we went to London and had a hilarious week of research because Ridley and I, we both said we're guys, so we don't want to go to the gift shop. We don't want to, you know, and we really don't want to hear anything that isn't useful to us. So we go to the Tower of London, which is, you know, a very famous historical tower, actually a group of buildings, and We skipped all the tour and everything else. It was the only reason we went there was to find out how would two kids escape from this particular spot.
So we're looking down the old toilets.
Yeah.
We're looking at the gates. Yeah. Everybody else is looking at the armor and the jewels, and we're over in the corner saying, is this really the old toilet?
They probably thought we were terrorists, you know, or skulking around taking pictures of things you don't really take pictures of. And we also, we had a scene set in Stonehenge.
So Dave has this idea to hire, you know, a formal guide, royal,
well, yeah, we had to go to Stonehenge.
Mounty something or other. Yeah, but most people just go to Stonehenge.
We had this one scene, so we get this guide, and he knows everything.
Oh, my gosh.
About Stonehenge. And he drove.
Run the Druids first!
Yeah. So he's driving us to Stonehenge, which is a couple of hours from London.
Never stops.
We're sitting there, and he talked the whole way about Stonehenge, 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 Stonehenge. All the way. And he really knew his Stonehenge. And we get there, finally, and it's, I remember it was like really cold and
really cold.
Rainy. And it was crappy. And there's, you know, Stonehenge is cool. It took us, I'd say, 8 seconds to admire.
Right.
And then he's going to start, I think, his.
There's about four other people there because we get there really early.
He's going to do his presentation on. On Stonehenge.
He sort of turns around and faces us, and you know.
If we go, all we really need to know is, could a guy hide, if a guy's over in that little valley there, would you be able to see him from here?
And he has a pass, so he's allowed to step over the rope, you know, we aren't.
He goes, that's all you want to know? Yeah. So really, that's all we need to know at this point. Could you go over and stand
just crouch in that trench?
So he goes over and crouches in the trench. He comes back and he goes, maybe we go, hey,
we're done.
We're done. We're good. And he goes, really? I don't think I've ever done a tour of Stonehenge. And we said, but we do need to find a house near here where you that has a wall where you can hide.
Has behind. To be near a creek.
Has to be near. And then he got into it. We explained what we were doing.
He really got into it. Man.
And he found his house, which turned out to be Sting's house. So we put Sting's house in our book. And don't tell Sting.
Yeah, we didn't pay him for that.
We didn't pay Sting. So anyway, that was Peter. And then we did. Then we that was our second. Then we thought we'll make a trilogy. Everybody should have a trilogy.
And I wanted to go to Morocco.
That's right.
Yeah, I was trying. Or Abu Dhabi or whatever. What's that place?
Once Ridley figured out it was all tax deductible.
Right. I started saying let's travel. Yeah. Dave said no. To
Peter
that.
Goes to Hawaii.
Yeah.
So he said we called the third book in the trilogy Peter and the Secret of Rundoon, and we wrote that and it was set in his.
And it really tied everything off.
It did. Yeah. And then. We wrote a fourth book in the trilogy.
But that was because we got threatened. That was terrorists. That was like 10-year-old terrorists.
Oh, yeah. We were. Kids were writing us letters saying.
They're going to murder our dogs and stuff.
You can't write another book. You have to write another book. Which is, again, that's sort of, I guess, the other side of the wonderful kid reader. But we wrote.
Change addresses often. Yeah.
So we wrote that book, and it was called Peter and the Secret of Rundoon.
Sword of Mercy. And that was partly because you discovered this amazing thing about the swords and the coronation.
It was more research. I actually did research.
Yeah. But just out of the blue, because we were done, and Dave wrote and said, okay, I've got an idea.
I had an idea for a book. Yeah, and then we wrote one other book in there called Science Fair, which is a modern-day kind of a comedy. That was fun.
Really fun book. The villains have no vowels in their names.
Yes, we felt really bad for the guy who had to read the book on tape. So it sounds like a man spitting.
Reverse human deconvert.
Yeah.
Say that 100 times throughout a book.
We've had some pretty wonderful experiences as a result of writing for kids. One of the big ones is we're published by Disney. And that's a very special way to get published. It's not like any other publisher.
We didn't know how special it was.
Yeah. Because they have these theme parks, Disney does.
Who knew?
Which seems to be a big part of the business. And so we end up doing events at the Disney theme parks. We did our first big Disney signing.
And at the Contemporary.
Hotel resort in Orlando. And they built an entire set, a ship, pirate ship with cannon that actually
just
shot.
Just behind us where we're going to sign.
Right. It didn't shoot real cannonballs because that would be a violation of the Disney code. But it did shoot. It made a lot of noise. Made a lot of booming.
Big boom.
And they brought Peter Pan and Captain Hook to the signing. The guys who play those parts.
Well, those are the real guys, Dave.
Yeah, that was the real Captain Hook. I don't think it was the real Peter Pan, though. But anyway, they came in their costumes, and they were dueling behind us and all around. It was great. We had hundreds of people. It was a great signing.
But we dueled with them. We had our pens. We were trying to test whether the pen was mightier than the sword.
It turns out it's not. No. The pen is not mightier than the sword.
Because the sword is longer.
The sword kicks the pen's butt in an actual duel.
It turns out.
But we I had to wait ahead of time for
in what we call a
green room.
Green room.
Right, which was just a locker room, a little locker room.
About the size of three phone booths.
Yeah, not a very big room. And I don't know where Captain Hook was, but we were in there for 15 minutes with Peter Pan.
We were.
Peter Pan. And he's like the guy who plays Peter Pan.
He's got his tights on.
Wiry guy wearing the green tights and everything. And we're in a little room with this guy.
What are you going to do?
We're going to make conversation. So I say to him, how do you like working here? And he goes,
it's a beautiful day in Neverland.
And then there's just like a long pause, really, and I suddenly realize that he's still Peter Pan, even when he's...
Dave says something like, so, you know, how about that Miami Heat? Have you seen Wendy?
It turns out Peter Pan has to stay in character. When you're wearing the tights, you're Peter Pan. So it's a long...
Long
15 minutes in the green room, Peter Pan. We also had a chance to be the grand marshals in the Disney Main Street parade, which was
turn that one down if you get that. Shirt.
Very exciting. We get to wear ears. they make
with
you
our names
they make
the
you
back.
Make you wear the ears.
I don't know where I might have lost mine.
I still have mine. You can have mine.
Okay.
And it turns out that when you're in the Main Street parade, you're not really what they're there to see. They're there to see all the people behind you. So you feel like the world's biggest dork is really the...
You feel like one of those cars that's running along the road in Iraq to detonate the bombs before the real guys get there.
Yeah. You know? But now you, Ridley Pearson.
Yes, sir.
You've written a bunch more books.
I have.
Called The Kingdom Keepers.
Right, from being in the theme parks.
And tell them about you've done some research.
But that was also because of you, because the first time I was going to go to Disney World in my life, I mentioned it to you, and you said, well, you're not going without me. So the two families went together, and because you are Dave Barry, I thought I had to one-ups you, because you told me you knew everything about Disney World, which turns out you do. And so I was, at that time, I was killing people for a division of Disney. My publisher was a division of Disney, and I called them and said, is there any way I can one-ups Dave Barry on this whole thing? And we get to our hotel, and they had cakes made out of our book covers that you could eat. And they had all our tickets comped, and they had a VIP guide for us. And we went through, the week before she had toured John Travolta. And we went through the park like reigning kings. We jumped the fast pass line, we went in the back door of Mickey's house and saw Mickey before other people did. It was just one of those over the top weekends. And I went back and thanked Disney, and it turned out it was Disney's children's side, Disney Books, that had made all these arrangements. So I thanked them, and we got talking about how Disney World's attractions are so different than a place like Six Flags or something, because they tell a story. And the editor said, well, have you ever thought about writing for kids? Peter Pan, the whole Peter and the Starcatchers had not happened at that point. And I said, yeah, in fact, on the way out, I realized that all the guests leave, but none of the characters leave. And it occurred to me, maybe all those characters are still inside the park having some kind of battle every night that we aren't aware of. And the editor said, well, why don't you write that up? So I ended up writing a series of books, still writing them, called The Kingdom Keepers, where five kids get inside the park after dark, which is every kid's dream, and they end up stuck in this battle between the good side of Disney and the villains of Disney. It's really been a lot of fun. I've got a ton of access. Because of my crime novels, I'd said, you know, the only way I can possibly do this is if you give me full access to your theme parks. And they went, that'll probably be a deal breaker. But a month later, they called back and said, okay, you've got full access. So both of us carry VIP passes and get in Disney parks anywhere around the world. And if I call in advance, they let me in at 5 in the morning, and I get to go on these rides and research them and do all this crazy stuff and then throw the kids into that in my book. So I really have a ton of fun.
Ridley, I was with Ridley, well, I think it was the first time you went underground, beneath.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's this whole city underneath Disney World, as most people know, where all the, they call it the Utilidor, where all the laundry is done and where, you know,
cotton candy,
everybody gets
around. And
you see
that.
Mickey walking around without his head on.
These big tunnels.
I know I shouldn't reveal that.
No, you
shouldn't. Strike that. So Ridley had this idea. This was when you were plotting your first Kingdom Keepers book, and it involved the trash disposal system, which was
very prominent in those tunnels. This big, huge pipe.
Anyway, so they're taking us a tour, and I think most of the time when people go on these tours, they're impressed by, like, you're seeing how the rides work from behind the scenes. You know, you get to go on the Pirates of the Caribbean ride, stand on the ship. You get to go in the Haunted Mansion, but not on the dune buggies. You're actually walking around. It's really a spectacular thing, and you're looking at all these things. And everywhere we go, the guide would show us some amazing thing. And Ridley's question would always be, so where would the trash go from here?
That's because I discovered, thanks to this guy, that they don't carry the trash.
See, he's still going to tell you about where
it's
the trash is.
Fascinating.
They suck the trash out of Disney World.
Through this mile and a half
they
suction system.
Into SeaWorld. Killing two birds with one stone.
That's very
That's funny. Not true. I just want to stress
true.
That I made that
That's
up
an
just
edit.
Now. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
In all their wisdom, one of the things that Disney does is they tour us a lot to promote these books, which is a lot of fun. And after the fourth book in our trilogy, they decided to wrap two different vehicles, one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast, in the artwork of our fourth book. Like a bus, you know, you can put advertising that you can see through the bus window, but on the other side of it, when you look at the bus, it looks like an ad. So,
but this was actually, it was a PT Cruiser?
It was a PT Cruiser in both cases, and they wrapped it with the artwork of our book.
And our names and everything.
Yeah. And so we called it...
The Swordmobile.
The Swordmobile.
Because it was the Sword of Mercy book. But it's a really kind of insane-looking vehicle we're driving around.
We only drove it at night, so nobody could see the
artwork
anywhere.
Not only at night, but in the rain. So we,
and in the boonies of Pennsylvania.
So we're driving down in the New Jersey Turnpike, area, in the rain and the dark, in our Swordmobile, thinking like, so what are people going to do? I kind of like,
pull over.
See this thing? And they're going to say, let's pull off it.
I'm going to order it right now.
Maybe there's a bookstore at exit 8 of the New Jersey
at
Turnpike.
3 in the morning.
We can purchase this book.
But we ended up in this vehicle, locked in this vehicle together for, I don't know, 10, 12 hours on the East Coast and probably the same amount of time on the West Coast. And never locked two authors who write together in a car for that long, because by the time we got out of the second car, we had plotted another book.
That's right.
And that is...
That was Science Fair, right?
Well, no, I thought that was the...
Oh, no, that's the book we're going to...
Yeah.
What am I thinking?
I think it
yes.
was.
No, you're right.
It was
right.
Bridge to Neverland.
I forgot. Was it when we started? Was on that book?
Yes, it was.
So, so we came up with a fifth, but it's not really... It's
related to...
And it's a book called The Bridge to Neverland, and it also, of course, involves the Peter Pan story, but it, first of all, it's set in modern times.
Contemporary, yeah.
It doesn't really... follow immediately. It's very different, it involves now and kids who live now.
And all I can say is, Dave, because I did this last night, don't go see the movie Thor.
Because why?
You will get sick to your stomach.
Why?
Because they use a major element of our book.
Oh, really?
In their movie.
Those bastards.
I know.
I didn't know that.
I know, nor did I until last night.
Name. Okay, well you find these
our famous bridge.
I hate to find that on a podcast.
Yeah, but we had a ton of fun writing that, and that comes out in August.
Yes,
called Bridge to Neverland.
Listen Up is brought to you by the International Reading Association and is exclusive to IRA's Teacher to Teacher membership community on Engage.